want to uphold UBC because I'm sure there's flaws there as well. I'm not saying it's perfect.
There are.
But like,
alumna.
Yeah. But the thing that they tried to create, like I think exactly what Trish is saying, like some level of independence for the investigative arm of the university from like both administration and faculty, I think is hugely important. You know, like we like, you know, like a quick, simple example, right? Like we have the vice provost research and international office, and we have a research misconduct like policy, which that office would investigate under, right? And simple questions about conflict of interest, which again, I'll talk about that for a second in a moment. But when you look at an issue of conflict of interest, right, you have this office that is supposed to investigate research misconduct and wrongdoing. But they also are responsible, and their primary role is to bring in research revenue to the university. So if you have a misconduct complaint against a faculty member that, for example, brings in a lot of money to the university, guess what? You probably are not going to want to initiate an investigation against that faculty member, right? So it's like a basic level, like at a base level, it's a conflict of interest that we have identified to the university. Mm-hmm. They reviewed the policy, but they haven't changed that aspect of it. Yeah. But when we look at that, like, it's actually the conflict of interest policy that is actually not great at this university either, because the entire policy talks about managing conflict of interest as opposed to avoiding it. And to Trish's point, I think it should be avoided the vast majority of time and only managed in cases where it can't be avoided.
Yep.
Right? But they just take a management approach to everything, right? Which has been hugely problematic. And based on all of this, like one small thing in terms of independence, I've just thought about, like, I don't know the feasibility of it because it really depends on the province, like thinking about these things in a more serious way, is that the investigations office for all universities should just be outside of the universities,
mm-hmm.
right? Like similar, like not like the BC Ombuds, because the BC Ombuds can't actually investigate and like intervene on cases. They can only review the outcomes of what has happened and do recommendations for future cases. But I'm like an actual investigative office that looks at present day complaints and cases would be, I think, hugely valuable.
Yep. And maybe there's a threshold where if a case is of a certain nature or a certain risk or a certain severity, it would be handled by that body, but smaller problems can be handled internally.
Mm-hmm.
I think financially that would make it more feasible.
Yeah.
Your point about the ethics in research, mm-hmm. I think, is particularly concerning given that we will be having a medical school at SFU soon, and that is going to include a lot more human subjects research. And so making sure that the university is well prepared to handle that in a way that is ethical and free of conflict of interest, I think, is important to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's talk about what students need to know when they are finding themselves caught up in this. And I think if you agree, maybe we'll break it up into two sections. Mm-hmm. One kind of like academic stuff, which I imagine sort of happens that people find out they're in trouble when they're told they're in trouble. And then a separate thing, you know, the, I think, perhaps more complicated issues around various relationships with supervisors and superiors. So in the academic questions, when a student gets notified that they're in trouble, they've done something wrong, or alleged to do something wrong, what should they do?
My first instinct would be to email Trish. And I recognize that not all students want to reach out for in-person contact and assistance. So I've made guides and breakdowns of policy that are available on my website through sfss.ca, services, student advocacy, that break down what to do, where to go, how each process works. But if you don't want to go that route, come talk to me. I can walk you through it. But generalized advice would be to keep everything in writing. I think Harjap will probably agree there. That if you are accused of an academic integrity violation, you should be able to meet with your instructor to talk about it before the official report is filed. And that is a hugely important piece of procedural fairness, that you have the right to respond to those allegations before it goes any further. And unfortunately, there's faculty that will skip that step. And a lot of things can just be cleared up in that initial meeting between a student and a faculty member. Once you've had that meeting, if an official report is filed, you have 3 weeks to file an appeal. And if you take anything from this chat, 3 weeks is the deadline for just about everything at SFU if you disagree with the decision that's been made. It's in tiny print behind two links, and I have been pushing to make that information way more obvious and upfront.
That's really fast when
it's fast.
A student's facing what probably for almost all of them is a super stressful experience. Yep.
And it's usually during exam time, and you're writing papers and trying to finish, and maybe your graduation is on the line. Like, it's never convenient. So that is the big piece. 3 weeks is that magic number. And if you go beyond that 3 weeks, they will almost never consider an appeal. Yeah.
I mean, I don't have much to add to that. Just aside from the fact that, like, I think going again to, like, Trisha's early comment about contact, you know, the advocate right away is also just, you know, sometimes, you know, to the point of, like, keeping everything in writing, which I echo as well, hugely important, doing things like timelines, right? Mm. Like, in terms of, like, dates, what happened, when it happened. But also, like, I think in meeting with either of us, you might become aware of things that might be relevant to your case that you would have thought otherwise weren't, right? Information, scenarios, what has happened. And I think just the ability to talk through what has happened with someone is hugely valuable for that reason, right? That you actually figure out, like, okay, you know, you just feel initially sometimes like this feels unfair. But because you don't really know policy and precedent and like how the university treats various cases, you might not kind of really be able to articulate why it's unfair. Mm. And that's why I think the value of the offices are really there, is that it really helps in that regard.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, let's talk about the other kind of more personal relationships type of scenarios that come up. Because in that situation, and the reason I wanted to separate it out is because often a student's sense that something's off or not right or maybe unfair is going to arise long before they get to the point of feeling they need to do file a formal complaint or enact some sort of process. And at the same time, I'm sure it's extremely difficult to deal with and sort of understand what they need to be doing. Mm-hmm. How can students navigate that? And what kind of resources, in addition to your offices, are available? Because I imagine talking and advice early on when you think things aren't quite right would be super valuable to those students.
Yeah, I think similarly, for the same reasons, right? Like, you kind of don't know precedent, you don't know what is possible, understanding policy. So for those reasons, again, just echoing, like, meeting with an advocate or someone is useful. The one other thing I would just say is that if you have some trust and good relationships with other, you know, for sure your peers as students, but also potentially with faculty, like, is asking a few kind of, like, not like controversial, but just some questions about, hey, like, find out a little bit more. Just because I think in a lot of those cases, you find out, like, whether the person you're having this issue with, these kind of personal, like, whether it's faculty or someone else, like, there might be a pattern of behavior. Mm-hmm. There might be, like, sort of some awareness that people have about the issue. You know, again, right, like, whisper networks used a lot among women or non-male identified folks in the community around, like, sort of sexual predators or sexual violence issues have been more, you know, people always say are more effective than the policies because they actually protect people and build awareness. Similar stuff happens around just kind of like personal levels of like harassment and abuse that might not be sexual violence, but just other forms of it, exploitation or like sort of poor behavior. One of the things that like I've really pushed for in my role after my first year was trying to collectivize sort of knowledge mm-hmm. around like what's going on in departments and with certain faculty members without like necessarily like this approach of being like, oh, we need to like dig up stuff on the person. But just like if there's an awareness and then there's a pattern, we should know. Right. So I think that's the other part of it that I think it's really difficult to do because the university processes really individualize a complaint. Right. Like they really want to just be like, OK, what's the issue? They'll focus it on a narrow policy. They'll focus it on a narrow single student case. They'll preach confidentiality over and over again so you don't talk to anyone. But it should be your right to talk to someone about the experiences that you have. So overcoming that stuff sometimes is a struggle. And again, why meeting with the advocacy office is it kind of helps people do that with confidence because we're not telling you to do anything that's like a violation of university policy. We're just telling you to be do your due diligence to know what's going on in terms of those interactions you might be having, right? So,
yeah, I think I would add to that to sort of trust your gut. You'd be surprised how often your gut is telling you what you need to know. Document the concrete facts as well as how your feelings come from those facts. And that can sometimes be different. And if you feel like you can speak to the instructor of the course about whatever the issue is, if that doesn't feel right, perhaps you can talk to a TA. If that doesn't feel right, there's maybe a faculty member somewhere in your department who's been an ally in the past or that you get along with. And I also find that depending on the department, sometimes the academic advisors can be surprisingly helpful for these situations for undergrads. Particularly in navigating sort of departmental personnel weirdness. I think those would be sort of my main points of advice there, and that it's okay to stick up for yourself. Mm-hmm. There absolutely is a power dynamic at play in most classrooms, and it's okay to stand up and say that this isn't okay. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes there's also odd cases where a student, for instance, reached out to me because in an assignment, they were transcribing material from an archive, and the student was concerned that that labor was going to be used by their professor in their research. And so I messaged the professor and said, I've received this concern. Is there anything that you would like to say and anything we could talk about here? And it turned out that it was completely unrelated to what she was studying, and it was really not an issue at all. But the student's concern was quite valid, but it just needed some clarification. And sometimes those conversations are hard to have.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, how do students get a hold of you, and how do they find the resources you guys have available for them? Trish, you're representing undergrads for the
Yes, Student if Society? You're an undergrad and you need help, my email is studentadv.coord@sfss.ca, which is really annoying, and I'm working on changing it. but my website's probably easier to find. Go to sfss.ca, services, student advocacy, and all my contact info is there. You can book an appointment with me through that website. We can do it in person or remote or at a Starbucks or wherever. Pretty flexible that way.
Yeah. Yeah, and so my email address is advocacy@sfugradsociety.ca. So the last bit's all one word. We're on the second floor of the Maggie Benson building. The GSS offices are there just a little bit past the bookstore. And my office is there. Again, reach out to me on email. We can similarly set up in person, virtual, whatever meetings. Vancouver campus if needed, mm-hmm. Surrey campus if needed, all of that kind of stuff. So like I said, similar to Trish, like get in touch with us early. Sometimes, like, even if you're not thinking of doing anything and you just want to be like, hey, this thing's going on, I just want to talk to someone about it, mm-hmm. totally okay to come and chat with us as well, right? Like, it sometimes is just helpful to, like, you know, throw ideas about what's going on with you to someone else that you want to talk about things confidentially with.
Great. Well, thank you for joining me here today, Trish Everett, Student Advocacy Coordinator for the Simon Fraser Student Society, and Harjot Gruel, Advocate and Policy Advisor for the SFU Graduate Student Society. Thanks for coming. I think this is a really important topic and some great information you've been able to share today.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
Great. That was Trish Everett, student advocate for the Simon Fraser Student Society, representing undergraduate students here at Simon Fraser University, and Harjap Gruel of the Graduate Student Society, who plays a similar role with the Graduate Student Society, representing the grad students at SFU. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. It's an interesting and complicated issue that really needs more attention at British Columbia universities and post-secondary institutions. In a moment, we will be bringing you Bird Note, and then please stay tuned after that for our weekly segment on Gardening with Embark.
This is Bird Note. If you're new to birding, you might be baffled by names like Couch's Kingbird, Wilson's Warbler, and Townsend's Solitaire. These birds were named in honor of scientists and their friends long ago. But the result is a long list of birds named after white men, many of whom took part in colonizing the Americas or enslaved people. The American Ornithological Society, or AOS, which governs official bird names in English, is working to rename all birds named after people in North America. The bird once called McCown's Longspur, for example, was originally named after a man who first collected the bird and later became a general in the Confederate Army. In 2020, the AOS renamed that songbird the Thick-billed Longspur, which instead highlights the big beak that distinguishes the species from other longspurs. In late 2023, after years of people campaigning for new bird names, the AOS said they'll rename 70 to 80 more species named after people, replacing them with names that call attention to distinctive traits of the birds. The goal is to make birding more inclusive and welcoming to everyone, and to make it easier for people to start getting to know their birds. After all, every friendship begins with learning a name. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
It's time for Gardening with Embark. Joining me here in the studio is Pablo Vimas of Embark. And we are, we're at week 26, halfway through the year now.
Correct. That's right. Week 26. And I'm happy to be back and continue sharing what's happening in our gardens.
And I guess we're also, for our area, at the beginning of the real summer.
Correct.
You know, I mean, last week officially summer started, but really it's with this transition, June-July transition, that we get into the real part of the summer. And that means some new tasks for the garden. We're bringing some new plants out right at this point.
Correct, yeah. So as the weather warms up, we start paying more attention to our summer crops, such as tomatoes, cucumbers, zucchinis. And at the same time, we want to still continue harvesting all the core crops, like lettuces and herbs. And so at the moment is a nice transition, which allows us to explore which parts of our garden are the ones that really get hot and which parts of our garden get cold. So those areas that are still cold in the shade, it still are wood spots for continue growing our cold vegetables.
And when you say cold, you're meaning shaded spots.
Shaded spots, yeah. So we can continue growing lettuces, spinach, pak choy, which don't like the direct sunlight, and cilantro as well.
Right. So kind of any of the leafy greens, we're going to want to put them into those slightly cooler, shadier spots.
Correct, yes.
But tomatoes, as we know, love the sun.
They do, yeah. We need to have them exposed to those sunny areas. And well, tomatoes at the moment, because of the sunlight, long days, they start growing. And it can get out of hand. They can get too big if we don't keep an eye on the side shoots.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are not familiar with the side shoots, is that between the main stem and a leaf, there is a bud, which allows the grow of a new, a new branch.
Mm-hmm.
And we usually nip those out because we want that the plant put most of the efforts in growing fruits, and no side shoots. So the more side shoots the plant has, the more branches the plant has, the more effort expends growing them. So let's trim them down so the plant puts more effort in making the delicious fruits that we are looking for.
So what people are looking for, as you say, there's going to be a little bud.
Correct.
Between the where the leaf is just starting to come off a branch or another stalk.
Yeah.
And people need to look for those.
And nip at them.
Nip them out.
Nip them out, yes. And don't wait till they get too big, like a pencil size, because you are creating a large wound. Mm-hmm. As soon as you notice that there are tiny little leaves in there, just nip them out.
And that, and so with the tomato plants, we don't want them to be too bushy and too full, because, as you say, then they're putting all their effort into leaves, and we want them putting it into fruit.
Yes, and as well, for us, as trying to hold a plant all together, so we start staking here, the tomato cage are not strong enough to hold the whole plant, and the whole plant start falling one side, squeezing all the plants that you have next to it. And at one point, you just give up, say, I cannot deal with that. This is a huge plant.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns when you have to harvest, you have your cherry tomatoes or your Roma tomatoes, and they are in the middle of the plant, and then you are just, I don't want to harvest, I might break the branches. So it's all as well about harvesting, having access to the fruits.
And so we need to create something that supports the plant, though. Not only tomatoes, but some of the other plants we're doing.
Yes, so we need to build structures, what we call trellises.
Yep.
So either for tomatoes, cucumbers, the tipis for beans. Mm-hmm. So those are structures. So this is as well a good time for us to bring our carpentry skills.
Yeah.
Gardening is a lot of skills that we can apply. One of them is carpentry. And so we can build those nice trellises in order to provide support for all our plants, climbing plants.
Right. So we're also looking at propagating some strawberries. Now, usually this is sort of the end of the strawberry fruit season, is it not?
Yes. It has been very cold and we are moving into the warm season. So strawberries, they will start growing runners.
Yeah.
So kind of a vine. And at the end of that on them, there is a tiny seedling, a new plant.
Yeah.
So we want to keep those, we like to trim those, nip them out. So either if the seedling is strong enough, we can replant. Mm-hmm. But if it's weak, we just don't worry about that. But we want to keep still the plant strong enough for a second growth.
Right.
Yeah, hopefully a second fruiting season.
And then we can get some more strawberries.
Correct, yeah.
It's so many, it really is a detail kind of thing with to really get the most out of your plants.
Correct, yeah. So the more effort you put into it, keeping, you will reap the benefits. As well, you can just be a laid-back gardener and say, okay, the plant knows how it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
I will just show up when it's need to harvest. But it's better to keep an eye on the plants. As well, with that, we continue keeping an eye on pests and diseases that they are now coming up. For instance, now we have cabbage butterfly laying eggs, and then we have the cabbage worm eating already. So this, and they're enjoying all our cabbage fruit.
Yeah.
Aphids are start coming up, and we will see that relationship between aphids and ants, and all the honeydew that they are producing, and the plants start being shiny and sticky.
Yeah.
Wasps show up because they are attracted with this honeydew.
Mm-hmm.
So you start seeing more wasps in your garden. And if you see one or two ladybugs, we are happy that ladybugs are eating the aphids.
Yeah,
so it's now we can see how all nature gets together and one supports to the other.
Yeah, excellent. Well, looking forward. It's wet right now, but we're looking forward to some nice sunny weather coming up, I hope.
I hope, yes. We are in a transition period. Remember the El Niño period just finished, and La Niña hasn't started yet, so we're just in that transition session.
Right.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Pablo. We'll have you back again next week. Tell us about how to find out about Embark.
Yes, so you can find about any information about Embark Sustainability Society at embarksustainability.org or our social media channels hashtag Embark Sustain.
Excellent. Thanks so much. See you again next week.
See you next week. Thank you.
Taking me.